This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Go ahead, say it. You know you want to. Goldman Sachs is facing federal fraud charges, and it made how much last quarter? The two aren't really related, but it sure doesn't look good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, today the 20th of April, and it is good to have you here. Goldman Sachs reported an eyebrow-raising number today, nearly $3.5 billion in quarterly profit, healthy by almost any measure. But there is a backstory here that's really kind of important. Like all investment banks, Goldman relies on its reputation to do business. If they think Goldman can't pay him back, other banks aren't about to lend money. All you have to do is think back to Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers if you need some real-life examples of that one. Now, with earnings like today's, nobody's questioning Goldman's ability to service its loans to pay people back, but its all-important reputation is still under attack, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Goldman Sachs is primarily an investment bank. It advises companies on mergers and acquisitions and helps them raise money. And it trades. A lot. David Stoles, a professor of finance at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern, he says to do all that, the bank needs cash.
An investment bank has to raise an enormous amount of financing. They obviously issue stock to raise equity financing, but they issue lots of bonds and borrow money.
Goldman Sachs borrows because it doesn't have big deposits like other commercial banks. It gets its money from lots of sources. One of the biggest is short-term loans from other banks. But those banks won't lend to Goldman if they don't think the firm will make good on its debts.
A firm like Goldman Sachs, reputation is extremely important, but you have to separate, to a certain extent, reputation from creditworthiness.
It was a lack of creditworthiness that brought down Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns. Lenders got nervous they wouldn't get their money back, so they stopped lending. With no money, those banks couldn't do business, and they collapsed. Anil Kashyap is a professor at the University of Chicago's business school. He says creditworthiness isn't a problem for Goldman, but all this attention from the government could be.
So I think amongst the consenting adults that participate in this market, I'm not sure that this is as critical for undermining their trust as the perception that if the government's out to get these guys, maybe we don't want to get tangled up in it and be transacting with them.
Kashyap says Goldman's allegedly dirty dealings probably won't turn out to be a big deal.
I don't think their customers are going to desert him.
He says in the end, this is all about reputation. And Goldman's reputation as a solid moneymaker will more than make up for a whiff of scandal. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The financial reform bill comes up for a key vote in the Senate Agriculture Committee tomorrow. Yes, I did say the Agriculture Committee. Derivatives contracts are a major part of that bill. Contracts that were first used by farmers as a way to sell their crops in advance. Derivatives trading has gotten amazingly more complex since then, as has the plan to regulate them, as Brett Neely reports now from Washington.
Derivatives were boring and safe for a few hundred years. Then, after deregulation in 2000, banks and hedge funds didn't have to trade derivatives on public exchanges anymore. The banks set the price, and the price was kept private. And no one knew how exposed those firms were to risk. We all know how that story ended. Now, the biggest banks like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan don't want to go back to the old ways, when clients could compare prices for the service, says David Min at the Center for American Progress. They like it the way it is.
Because there's not efficient pricing there, these big five derivatives dealers can really charge through the roof for these derivatives products. And that's one big reason why they've been so profitable.
JP Morgan makes at least $700 million a year off of trading derivatives. The banks argue that derivatives help airlines and manufacturing companies hedge risk by locking in prices for essential goods, from fuel to steel. That way, they can at least count on steady costs, if not steady sales. David Hirschman is with the Chamber of Commerce, which wants major industries exempted from regulation.
The whole point of the exercise is to transfer that risk somewhere else so that you can be in the business of producing beer or making widgets or, you know, whatever it is you do.
But not every business agrees that huge industries should be exempt. Sean Cota runs a family-owned heating oil business in Vermont. He says using derivatives purely to speculate on the price of oil has hurt his business and consumers' wallets.
We calculate that this unregulated market has encouraged speculative fervor that costs about a dollar per gallon.
If the Senate Agriculture Committee approves the legislation, it heads to the Senate floor. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Corporate profits and derivatives thereof no doubt helped send the major indices higher today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Even if you're really diligent about your salt intake, you don't add too much to the food you eat at the table, you check labels as best you can in the stores, the average American still eats about a teaspoon and a half of salt every day. A federal advisory group, the Institutes of Medicine, says that is way too much. Today, the IOM officially recommended that the Food and Drug Administration force a gradual cutback in how much salt is allowed to be in processed foods. We've called Dr. Benjamin Jones to talk some about this. He is a flavor chemist at David Michael & Company. That's a food flavoring company in Philadelphia, PA. Dr. Jones, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
This thing that we all have on our dining room table, salt, it's not just about taste, right? It is an ingredient that people use for actual, you know, food chemistry reasons, isn't it?
Well, a classic example is the processed meats. It's used as a binder to help hold everything together, especially hot dogs, bologna, similar products. It's also used as part of the curing process for things like country ham, if you ever get in the southeastern United States. And it's also involved in getting baked goods to set up properly and puff up nicely when you're running them through the bakery.
So what happens to my kids on a Sunday morning when I make my buttermilk pancakes and I don't put that salt in there? I mean, they're not as puffy.
They won't be quite as puffy and they won't taste right either. They'll be kind of flat.
All right, so I'll get some complaints from the kids, I suppose. So what do we do then if the FDA goes along with these recommendations and says, listen, we have to cut gradually the amount of salt in our foods? How do we replace it? How do we keep the chemistry going?
Bear in mind, the bulk of your salt is coming from processed foods, things like soups, gravies, frozen dinners. So the salt they're asking to be taken out of those type of foods really isn't involved in the process. That's all involved in flavor. And with what the government's calling for, my personal opinion is it's not a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
Slowly reduce the salt. Just bring it down a little bit at the time. And for the most part, people will most likely not notice. This kind of thing was done in Britain several years ago with a great deal of success.
You go to the supermarket, you buy a can of soup, it's got like 1,000 milligrams of salt in it, or whatever the amount is, it's pretty high. What does that soup company do? Can it just cut back on that salt and hope we'll get used to it?
Actually, they can. They can slowly lower the salt, and that will become the new norm for people. And if you take them back to the original, they'll go, oh my word, what's all this salt in here? Why is it so salty? I can speak from personal experience on that. I worked for a major food manufacturer for years, and for a while I was involved on the regular side of the product line, and then they moved me over to the reduced sodium side. And initially, you know, I kind of like, well, this stuff needs more flavor, and then I became very accustomed to it. When they took me back over to the regular line, my reaction was, who dumped the salt shaker?
Yeah,
it's all learned. We don't start off our lives wanting a lot of salt. We learn to want a lot of salt because of what we eat. If we slowly reduce it, for most people, it's not going to be an issue.
Just to the flavor point one more time, we can also throw other stuff in there that's going to, you know, help us forget that the salt's not there.
That's true. We can add flavors, and working as a flavor chemist, that's close to my heart. One of the classic things that a cook will do is use spices to make up for it. So there's a whole slew of tools available, but there's no magic bullet. There's no single, oh, this is the one thing you drop in and you're good to go. It's going to have to be almost a product-by-product reformulation work.
What about the expense for people? I mean, does this have a financial impact as well?
It's going to cost more. That's reality. Salt is cheap, and anything you're doing to replace it or make up for the reduction in salt is going to add cost to the product. It shouldn't be a lot, but it is going to be there.
Benjamin Jones, he is a senior flavor chemist at David Michael. It's in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Dr. Jones, thanks so much for your time.
Quite welcome. Thank you.
Google has had nothing to say about the story in the New York Times today about that Chinese hacking attack of late last year. That's the one that eventually led to Google's decision not to censor search results in China and so effectively led them to pull out of the Chinese market. The Times says a key Google password was the target of those attacks. Google is just the latest high-profile company to have problems in the world's biggest market. And while Beijing does still insist it is open for business, our China correspondent Scott Tong has seen some evidence to the contrary. Hey, Scott.
Kai, hello.
So let's review here for a second, all right? We've got Google having pulled out of China. We've got foreign executives at Rio Tinto, the big mining company, sitting in a jail in Shanghai someplace. The American Chamber of Commerce is screaming about protectionism and how hard it is to do business over there now. Is it getting a little tense, the mood?
There's grumbling, not from every sector, but let me tell you about the American Chamber of Commerce in Beijing, which represents the big American companies in China. Mm-hmm. And in a new report, they say there's a mounting number of challenges here, which is a very nice Chamber of Commerce way to say it. Privately, business people are saying China's acting like big man on campus, and there are other less radio-friendly ways to say what they really think. It's in that environment that these new Chinese regulations came out. And they basically say the welcome mat is still out for the foreigners. We still welcome foreign acquisitions of Chinese companies. We have new tax breaks for R&D centers to be set up in China. There's new openness in China's financial sector. We're now going to let foreign companies issue stocks and bonds in China. So Chinese investors can buy shares of HSBC Bank or General Electric the same way they snatch up chicken nuggets and Levi's, Kai.
Yeah, so it sort of sounds like they know that foreign investment is key, but, right?
Well, yes, because foreign investment, opening up to the rest of the world, is a centerpiece to the China story of the last 30 years. Foreign companies come, they bring their ideas, they bring their capital, they bring their technology and management, and they match it up with Chinese land and Chinese labor. And that's been a big part of the China story. It sounds really easy, but in the early days, it was really difficult because the foreign companies had to come into state-run China and kind of teach capitalism 101. I spoke to a man named Michael Morris, who was here in the Stone Ages in the late 70s with the Pepsi Company. And they set up a factory here. And in the early days, they had to teach the line workers, you know what? Some of this property belongs to the company. You're not allowed to take it home.
We would have trucks that would just disappear. And the forklifts would disappear. And you'd say to these guys, what happened to the trucks? Oh, I had some coal to ship.
Well, now fast forward 30 years, Kai, and it's the Chinese who are laughing now, yeah, to the tune of the third largest economy in the world and on Japan's tail for number two right now. And a lot of it, as they say, is foreign investment, Kai.
Yeah, but so China's been, you know, the factory to the world for 30 years now. How much longer can that really go on, though?
Well, there is a shelf life. Labor costs are going up, and a lot of Chinese don't necessarily want to be the factory to the world anymore. The idea is, you know, the Chinese government isn't going to make things that easy for the foreigners anymore.
Yeah, what they want to do, to borrow from the world of sports, they want to raise their game, right?
Well, the sports parallel is the professional sports league in China, the professional basketball league. Yeah. Every team gets a couple foreigners to raise the level of play. Usually it's a couple washed-up players from the NBA who come. But the idea is, you know, we want to import this talent for a little while and then build it up for us. And then, you know, thank you very much. Goodbye. We're going to get pickier over time. And as far as businesses, China's saying, well, going forward, we don't want the foreigners if they're polluters or if they waste energy. If they're high tech, if they set up call centers, if they set up regional headquarters, yes, we want you. If you're in one of those sectors, kind of the future of China, China 2.0, then the future may still be pretty good. If you're not, one investment manager said, you better put on a sweater underneath that parka because the environment is getting a little chillier.
Scott Tong at our bureau in Shanghai. Thank you, Scott.
All right. Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, Little Rock weathers the economic storm.
We've seen a little bit of an effect from the stimulus on, say, government-type jobs, but we haven't seen a real fallout into the industrial world of any great significance at this point.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 25 points today, a quarter of 1%, finished at 11,117. The NASDAQ rose 20 points, that is 0.8%, closed at 2,500 on the nose. The S&P 500 added 9 points, also 0.8%, ended the day at 1207. Those huge Goldman earnings we told you about earlier, Goldman still lost 2% on continued worries about its SEC civil suit, but other financials did cash in. Morgan Stanley pocketed a 3% gain today. Citigroup added 1.8%. Bank of America rose up 1.2%. Bonds dipped just a little bit, left the yield on the 10-year T-note at 3.80%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the New Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at HBR.org. And by Vanguard. Vanguarding is an investment philosophy designed to help individuals reach their financial goals. Vanguard.com. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. President Obama meets with senators at the White House to discuss a Supreme Court vacancy left by the retirement of Justice Stevens. Money, money, money. The new design for the C-note is unveiled. And you know what's prompting this? Volcano activity. The Congressional Hazards Caucus Alliance holds a public briefing titled Reducing Volcano Risks, Progress Since the Cataclysmic Eruption of Mount St. Helens. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, losing your cell phone isn't really that big a deal. We've all done it, some of us, more than once. Left it at work or the gym, maybe at a restaurant. Last month in Silicon Valley, a very important cell phone was left behind at a bar. What is widely believed to be a prototype of the new iPhone that Apple's officially going to release in a couple of months. The phone wound up in the hands of Jason Chun, the editor of the technology website Gizmodo.com. Jason, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Suffice it to say, this is not the way that Apple and its product launches are usually covered.
No, they definitely do not want people seeing it until Steve Jobs gets on stage and tells them this is new iPhone.
So how did this one happen? I mean, how did this come to pass?
Well, a software engineer left it in a bar after I think he had a little too much to drink on his birthday. Someone else found it, and they offered it to us, which we paid for, and then we took it back to our offices and took it apart and examined it to make sure it was the real thing. And from what we saw, it definitely was.
How do you know? I mean, what convinced you that this was an actual Apple prototype?
Inside the phone, in the components, it actually says Apple on various pieces. And if that wasn't enough, which it should be, Apple actually wanted it back and claimed that it was their property. So that definitely says this is a legit piece of hardware.
Yeah, they actually sent you a letter yesterday that said, we understand you have something of ours, we want it, right?
Right, exactly. And then shortly after that, we returned the phone to them.
Let me ask you this, Jason. Obviously, this worked out well for you. You spent $5,000 to buy this thing from the guy who found it in the bar where the kid lost it. You got Lord knows how many hits on your website from Apple aficionados and other journalists and just plain curious people. So it has kind of worked out well for you, this technology scoop that you got.
In terms of scoops, this is one of the largest ones you can get because of how secretive Apple is and how closely they guard their products before launch. Before this, you used to only get images or a blurry video of people in factories maybe sneaking a little peek. But to get this kind of detail, I haven't seen before, and it would probably be fair to say it's hard to see this happening in the future, especially with Apple tightening their security and trying not to let this happen again.
They have actually a history of giving people their devices and letting them use them, isn't that right, just to test them out in the real world?
That's true, and that's why this was leaked in the first place. They have their engineers that go out and test it in real-world conditions to see how reception is on the train or in a bar, for example. So they need to have actual real-world data to tune their products. So it's unfortunate that he left it when he was out on a testing run. But I don't know if going to bars was part of his testing criteria.
Yeah, Steve Jobs probably disapproves of that one. what did you learn about the 4G phone itself? Is there anything whiz-bang that we're going to get in June when this thing comes out?
Besides the battery being slightly larger, I would say the biggest feature is the camera on the front, which is a video camera, so you can do video chats with, say, other phones or even with computers, most likely. So you can hop on Skype or hop on iChat and do a little conversation while you're on the go and show people what you're looking at and see what they're looking at. So it's more of a personal conversation than just talking on the phone even, because you can visualize and see who you're talking to.
You gonna buy one?
Definitely.
Jason Chen, he's the editor of the website Gizmodo, talking to him about the new 4G iPhone prototype that he got his hands on. Jason, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
As the economic policy story has played out over the past couple of years with bailouts and stimulus and healthcare and financial reform, it's easy to think that what happens in Washington, D.C. is what's happening out in the actual economy, because the politics of economics does get a whole lot of headlines, after all. What we don't often hear much about, though, is how what happens in Washington plays out in the rest of the country. Little Rock, Arkansas, is faring better than most. An unemployment rate of 7.3% looks pretty good right about now. So it's worth asking the question, how has Washington affected the place? We sent John Dimsdale from Washington to find out.
In a sprawling set of hangars alongside Little Rock's airport, the French corporate jet maker Dassault Falcon outfits the private jets used by executives of Fortune 100 companies all over the world. There are leather seats, flat panel TV screens, and laminated wood appointments of hickory, cherry, or oak. My factory tour guide was Rick Cart.
The customers handpicked everything from the silver and crystal that will go into these cabinets to the espresso microwave machines, the shades of gold, the laminate.
Dassault Falcon is one of Little Rock's largest employers. Woodworkers, painters, carpet layers. Last year, the factory outfitted a record 77 jets using 2,000 workers. But contracts for new corporate jets have plummeted. Dassault Falcon had to lay off nearly a quarter of its workforce, and not just because of the recession. Vice President Robert Smith says Congress heaped insult on injury when it grilled auto executives for flying in their private jets to ask for a taxpayer bailout. That hurt sales and cost jobs.
You go back and remember the famous Citibank airplane. I think they got pressured, since it is Citibank, into canceling that jet. Well, that was an airplane we were building here in Little Rock, and the day that that airplane was canceled, we were actually moving it across the tarmac over to the flight line to get ready for delivery.
Smith says Congress should be more sensitive to how even offhanded remarks can affect business.
You know, every time an airplane's canceled, it affects an awful lot of workers here.
Not far away from Dassault Falcon is a newer factory. A year ago, the Indian company Wellspun opened a giant warehouse to make oil and gas pipes. It's the company's first facility outside India. Little Rock attracted Wellspun with generous tax breaks, hospitality, and a location near a major river. But the timing wasn't good. Recession ate away at the expected orders for pipes, and Vice President Rajesh Chokhani says the economy caused some second thoughts about the expansion into Little Rock.
There were times that there were a lot of thoughts, not second, there were third, fourth, and fifth thoughts gone into the mind.
So far, Chokhani hasn't laid off any of the 400 workers, but he's counting on Washington's endorsement of expanded offshore oil drilling.
Because if any drilling happens, the medium for transportation of oil or gas is pipes. So that is directly affecting our business, and it's very positive. It's good.
Washington can give, it can also take away. Little Rock's banking community is upset with Congress's vote for a government takeover of student loans. Bill Scholl, the president of Arkansas's second-largest bank, First Security, says his bank has about $40 million in outstanding student loans. The bank likes helping Arkansas families it's done business with for years.
We would like to stay in that business. It's not a very profitable business, but it's a good business from the total customer relationship side. So we're frustrated with that.
And Scholl says Little Rock's business community doesn't give Washington's efforts to soften the recession much credit. He says the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department did the right thing, saving the big banks and keeping credit flowing, but he's not impressed with federal incentives to create jobs.
We've seen a little bit of an effect from the stimulus on, say, government-type jobs, but we haven't seen a real fallout into the industrial world of any great significance at this point.
And Little Rock Chamber of Commerce President Jay Cheshire says local businesses worry about a regulatory crackdown on things like credit cards or carbon emissions.
Making regulation so burdensome to where businesses can't be nimble in this global environment is going to be detrimental to our future economy, much less in getting us out of this existing negative economy.
Little Rock business leaders say their area avoided an economic bust because it didn't have an economic boom. Slow, steady growth, helped along by their central location and diverse economy, are the reasons for their success. And all that's in spite of government policies, not because of them. In Little Rock, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. By the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note today to bookend the Goldman Sachs story we started with this afternoon. Former Lehman Brothers CEO Richard Fuld was on Capitol Hill today testifying about his company's collapse of a year and a half ago. Fuld apologized to those who lost money or were otherwise hurt by what happened at Lehman. But then he said in almost as many words, "I didn't do it."
"I have absolutely no recollection whatsoever of hearing anything about or seeing documents related to Repo 105 transactions while I was the CEO of Lehman."
Repo 105, you might remember, was the story that broke a couple of weeks ago, the creative way, you might say, that Lehman Brothers kept itself solvent in the face of its deepening crisis. Our crisis right now is time. We got to go. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday. Today, the Dow added 25 points. That's a quarter of 1%. The NASDAQ gained 20 points, about 0.8%. The S&P 500 gained 9 points, also 0.8%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on the Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you can tune tomorrow morning and every morning, Monday through Friday, for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this radio broadcast, farmers and climate change.
If you do nothing, things get worse. And if there is a real problem, whether it's my problem or my neighbor's problem, we have to work on it.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening
because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.